Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Innovation Forum webinar. My name is Innovation Forum, and I'm delighted to be facilitating this discussion today. We've got two fascinating speakers. We were due to have one other, but he was unable to make it, unfortunately. But I am very happy that joining us today is Pascal Brune, who is Head of Sustainability at H&M, and Stefan Seidel, who's Head of Corporate Sustainability at Puma Group. And the idea of this webinar, as you can see from our one title slide, is to talk about how action on climate change will transform the apparel industry. And both Puma and H&M have been doing important work in this space around climate for a number of years. So our colleague from Hugo Boss, Andreas Stoibig, sends his apologies but is unable to make it. But I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for Stefan and for Pascal. I will ask a couple myself. There is a question box which appears on your webinar software. If you keep your question short and to the point and relevant, I shall be able to ask it, I hope. But I apologize in advance if I can't get through all of the questions. The idea of this webinar is very much to discuss the practical things that the companies are doing, Puma and H&M, on climate change. And we will be continuing that discussion at our Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference, which takes place on the 28th and 29th of April 2020 in Amsterdam. So, Stefan, Pascal, thank you very much for joining us. I had said that I would ask you both to do a quick overview of the work you've been doing, and then we'll get into some more specific questions and then some from the audience. So, Pascal, why don't you start us off? Thank you so much for joining us, and perhaps you could give us an overview of the approach you've been taking to climate change in recent years at H&M, and then we can start to boil down a bit later into some of the more specific work you've been doing. But for now, thank you for joining.
Well, great, thanks, Tobias. Well, basically, we have started our work on the environment side some years back. We started in late 90s, 1990s, about our first chemical actions and chemical audits. But and since then, obviously, a lot of things has happened, a lot of things and a lot of milestone has happened within H&M and H&M Group. But first of all, I would like to mention why is it such importance at the moment and now more than ever to focus on climate and environmental actions. I mean, we all know that by 2030, we will be 8.5 billion people on the planet, which will basically increase the resource demands and as well the pressure on people as well. So basically, we have taken the responsibility to work on that and to make sure that we have a circular approach in everything we do, in order to basically create and minimize our impact and as well create positive impacts on the environment, planet and people. So the whole idea is about how can we use fashion as a lever to create positive change within the industry.
Thank you. And we'll come back to you in a minute because I'd like to hear about your specific targets. And of course, there's the obvious question that you always get asked, Pascal, which I'll give you a minute to think about while we hear from Stefan. And of course, the obvious question that I'm sure you always get asked by people is, well, surely sustainability, circularity, climate change for a company like H&M means the end of fast fashion, doesn't it? And I'm sure you've been asked that question before. So I'll let you ponder that for a minute and we'll come back to the specifics. Stefan, over to you, and I'm interested to hear about the evolution of your approach on climate change over the last few years.
Yeah, thanks, Toby, and thanks for having me on that webinar. Yeah, climate change is something that we have thought about for a longer time. We have committed to setting a science-based target during the Paris Agreement or the Paris Climate Conference. Before that, we already had energy efficiency targets and we did report our greenhouse gas emissions. But with the Paris Agreement, and at that time, as it was happening in Paris, and we were part of the carrying group which is also based in Paris. We were sponsoring part of the event. We really took off to look at climate change and climate action in a more holistic way. Then we did look at our own emissions, which we obviously reduced and continue to reduce by the use of mainly renewable electricity and increasing the efficiency of our buildings and our car fleet. However, we are also quite clear, and we saw that as well in our environmental profit and loss account that we first published in 2011, that of course the majority of the environmental footprint and here also the carbon footprint of our organization, not surprisingly, is in the supply chain and the scope 3 emissions and not so much in our own operations. So we did look at how we can reduce emissions in the supply chain. And of course, first and foremost, what you don't measure, you cannot manage. So we started measuring greenhouse gas emissions from our direct suppliers about 10 years ago, I would say. We're reporting average emissions on a pair of footwear, so a pair of shoes on a piece of apparel, accessories partially. We're reporting that as part of our annual financial and sustainability reporting. And of course, then we also started working with those suppliers on energy efficiency programs. We had a large energy efficiency program and resource efficiency program a couple of years back that actually our colleagues from H&M also joined at one point, the SAFE program. We followed up that SAFE program with programs with the International Finance Corporation, so energy efficiency programs there in our major sourcing countries here, Vietnam and Bangladesh, for example. And more recently, we are also starting to support the move of our suppliers towards renewable energy. So here, for example, installation of solar PV energy generating stations on the rooftop of our core suppliers. So that in a nutshell is what we have done, but we have also realized when we wanted to set that science-based target that in order to hit what science tells us is required to stay below 2 degrees or now even below perhaps 1.5 degrees, that in no way we can do this in isolation. We're a small company, we have a big name, but compared to some of the very big players in our industry, we're a relatively small company. So we tried to find some friends to have a joint industry initiative and effort, especially when it comes to the supply chain. And therefore, we were quite active in founding the Fashion Charter on Climate Action under the umbrella of UNFCCC. That is now up and running since not quite 2 years, 1.5 years, I would say. And we see that this is a promising initiative, but of course we also see that if we really want to go to that ambition level of 1.5 degree or even further, as Pascale, this organization, has set sort of a even carbon positive target, then we need to really look at every single aspect of the whole value chain. So starting from raw material production into the sort of transition of those raw materials into fabrics and components, the logistics parts, or the transportation, and of course the finished goods manufacturing as well, then logistics again. And finally, we also then need to think on how we can work with our consumers or encourage our consumers as well to reduce greenhouse gas emissions when they're wearing our products. Not so much on the footwear side or accessories, but on apparel, of course, the product use phase is also a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions. So perhaps I'll stop here and let Pascal answer the obvious question.
Yes, thanks very much. And what I'd like you both to do in a minute is just clarify what your science-based targets are, just so everybody's very clear about what your actual objectives are, sort of the published headline numbers, if you like, because I think that's quite helpful for people to understand. But before that, yes, Pascal, the obvious question that I'm sure you get asked a lot about fast fashion and H&M, please go ahead.
Well, great. I will use that question as well to answer a bit what we have done within the environmental and then climate agenda. Well, obviously, I mean, we know that the industry needs to change. I mean, I mentioned about the little bit about the why, but I mean, we need to understand that the industry to survive needs to change, and fast fashion as well. So basically, it's really about how do we work in a way that we create positive impacts to the environment. And the only credible answer to that is to work through a circular approach. So that's a bit what we have started to do all over these years, to have a circular approach in everything we do. So we have started from design, to the choice of materials, to the production processes, to the customer use, and how do we educate customers, and to the end use of the product as well, and the end life. And in every step of this life cycle of the product, we have started to work on some very heavily, on others a bit less, but we have an agenda towards 2030 and 2040 as milestone towards our climate positive value chain goal. So what we have started to do, I mean, when it comes to the choice of materials, I mean, we set 10 years ago already a goal of having sustainable and sustainably sourced cotton by 2020. And broadly speaking, we will be able to have that goal achieved this year. So all our cotton are at the moment either recycled, organic, or sustainably sourced through the Better Cotton Initiative. And this is part of a larger goal, which is by 2030, 100% of our materials will either be recycled or sustainably sourced. And here, broadly speaking, we can say that at this stage, we have achieved 57%. So a larger share of our assortment has, at this stage, are either recycled or sustainably sourced, which contributes to less impact on the environment. And we are continuously looking for innovation, looking for partnerships with different innovators around bringing new materials into scale. If we look at production processes, I mean, we are as well looking into collaboration here at a large scale when it comes to energy efficiency, when it comes to renewable energy in our supply chain, and how do we scale those cleaner energy processes through our production process. And here we have been collaborating, as Stefan was saying, with Puma on different topics there, on different agenda. We are as well quite heavily engaged on the chemical and how we are cleaning up the industry of hazardous chemicals through the ZDAC program. So we are basically, I mean, a heavy part of our agenda today lies on supply chain and production processes to make it water efficient, energy efficient, and chemical hazardous chemical phased out. And then, I mean, looking into the full value chain, I mean, we are looking into how we educate our customers around different initiatives that as well we have launched in our stores, like Take Care, Repair and Remake program. How do we educate customers to make a better use of their garments and keep their garments for a longer lifespan as well. And then towards the end use of the garments with our garment collecting program, and basically with the ambition to close loop the whole process while recycling and upcycling our garments towards new life and new products. So basically it's a full holistic approach of the full value chain of the life cycle of the garments, which basically has been adopted since quite long already at H&M. I mean, and now it's really about connecting those dots, getting a transparency as well along the way towards our customers, towards our stakeholders and different partners, and basically to enable customers to make conscious choice as well. So really to get the full value chain transparency in place in what we do in order for for our customers and stakeholders to be able to make informed and conscious decisions.
Great, thank you, Pascal. I mean, there's so much to talk about there. We will discuss some of the things that you've mentioned, but thank you for those kind of headline targets. Stefan, similarly, could you just summarize for us what you're currently aiming for at the moment in numbers? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So you ask about the science-based target. So our science-based target that we just agreed last year is basically reducing our own emissions by 35% absolute until 2030 from a 2017, I think we landed eventually baseline year. We've hit that already. So we're already 50% down, more or less. In 2019, so that is not the most ambitious target. But then when it comes to scope 3 emissions, we said we want to reduce our emissions by 60% in the same period of time. But that relative to sales, because we also want to continue growing as a company, as we have done, thankfully, over the last years. So therefore, in the supply chain, we put this relative target of 60%. And here, of course, is the much bigger challenge, as mentioned before. Pascal talked about materials, and I believe it is very important and necessary to talk about materials as up to half of the greenhouse gas emissions and also other environmental impact that our products create are in the material phase. So likewise, we have set material targets. We set in 2015, we set 2020 targets to have 50% more sustainable cotton and polyester and 90% more sustainable leather and cardboard. So we also hit those targets prematurely in 2018 already. We hit the 50% mark. Now for 2019, the figures are not out yet, so I probably shouldn't mention them, but was significantly higher, not at the 100% level as H&M mentioned, but we're getting close. And on the polyester, which is our other big material, we're already getting relatively close to the 100% mark. And here again, also to stress that it's not necessary all recycled polyester or recycled cotton, but we also count in Better Cotton Initiative cotton, which is really the majority share. Or for example, Blue Sign certified polyester, besides also a smaller share of recycled polyester. So those targets are there and we're on track. We're even exceeding our targets. And eventually, I would agree with Pascal and H&M's targets that for the most important materials, there can be only the target to source all of those most important materials more sustainably. What that means in detail remains to be seen and discussed. But that is a very important element towards A, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and B, also becoming more water efficient, becoming more chemical compliant in the manufacturing process, or hopefully we are already chemical compliant, but sort of also valuing our commitment towards the Zero Discharge of Hazardous Chemicals Foundation to phase out all hazardous chemicals from all pathways in our supply chain. So those are a couple of the targets we have. We have other targets, obviously, as well on water and air pollution, etc. But yeah, again, I think I'll stop here and see what other questions are coming up.
Great, thank you. I mean, there are lots and lots of questions coming in here, which are really interesting. I had a quick question for you both about BCI, the Better Cotton Initiative. If I'm not mistaken, you both mentioned it. And you talk about certification, and I assume from what you're saying, Better Cotton Initiative certification counts towards your sustainable sourcing targets. Pascal, let me ask you about this first. How confident are you that the standards of BCI are up to scratch as we head towards 2030? Do you see that initiative, which has some extraordinarily large numbers of farmers and farms and so on who are apparently certified, or engaged. Do you see that organization as having to kind of radically improve and tighten up its standards in order to meet the demands of stakeholders and others who are looking at the impacts of materials in the field? Just really curious to see how you see that bit of sustainable certification evolving.
Great. Well, obviously, I mean, we can only recognize the achievement of BCI so far. I think BCI has achieved a great, tremendous works within the cotton industry to become a mainstream material and certification. And basically, it comes with the whole point of how do we evolve around the certification and the standard, and that's basically, I mean, what BCI needs to constantly review, and I know that they are constantly looking into standards revision and so on. I think the standard has to be inclusive and to be challenging enough to be recognized and credible over time. So I think there is a fine line between being able to include everyone on the change, because a change had to happen within the cotton field and the cotton industry, and that's what BCI has managed so far to provide. They have managed to provide a change in how the cotton is cultivated and grown. But of course, I mean, when you are like this multi-stakeholder organization, you need to get to a phase-wise approach, and that's what I appreciate with BCI to have this constant review of standards and have standard revision on the top of their agenda constantly. So I think it's a moving standard, it's a moving target, and I will really recommend BCI to treat that on the top of their agenda if they don't. But I know by fact that they are in looking into standard revision all the time, and that's how we will manage step by step to get a better cotton industry and cotton green sector.
Okay, thank you, Pascal. A similar question for you, Stefan. I mean, Pascal may have answered the question for you in some senses, but very interested to hear your point of view on BCI, as I believe you mentioned it as well.
Yes, indeed. So I'm in this industry almost since 20 years in sustainability, and I remember early sustainability reports of major fashion players saying that they want to scale up their usage of organic cotton to something like 50% or whatever targets they gave, and then for years nothing really happened, besides niche collections and maybe one or the other niche company who focuses their market differential on sustainability really going full force in on organic. But eventually for a mass market consumer brand like ours, it was not feasible to go to 100% organic, and neither did our major competitors. And so therefore, the emergence of BCI, which is a standard, which does have positive impact on the farmer level, is very much applauded, I would say, from the industry, because that allowed and does allow companies like H&M and ours and others who are really serving a big volume to go for 100%, let's say, certified cotton. Now, of course, the question is that, good enough, the standard of BCI, and you can debate that probably forever and find some areas for improvement, which I would also concur with Pascal that there are areas for improvement. But the important thing is that finally we're getting a handle, not directly, but at least indirectly via BCI, on our full cotton supply chain. And in our case, that's over 20,000 tons of cotton per year. That is a lot of cotton, and that's a lot of farmers who are benefiting. So indeed, I think it's a very good initiative, and we will also watch out as members and partners and make sure that the standard is going in the right direction. So rather increasing the level here of scrutiny and also improvement than the other way around. I would like to say one more thing on cotton, though. I do believe that the growing of cotton has a big land use impact and has a big water impact. So Pascal mentioned recycled cotton. I did not perhaps mention recycled cotton, but for me, I think that is the future, that we are trying really to reuse the cotton that is already in the cycle. And it seems that there is first success stories from the denim industry and others of using recycled cotton, including my own company, not my company, but the company I work for. So I believe that over time we'll also see a shift from virgin cotton into more use of recycled cotton fibers, and that will help as well to improve here the environmental footprint quite significantly.
Great. I just would like to add something just around cotton as well. I think it's quite important in this cotton discussion to not put cotton against or different certification against each other. They should all work in a kind of ecosystem where one will enable another one. Either it could be recycled cotton, better cotton, or organic cotton, or other type of cotton. I think we need to make sure that they all go towards the right direction in getting into more positive climate impacts, and where farmers are also protected in the whole equation as well. So I think we will just benefit to the cotton industry if we put those together and not against each other. I think it's quite important that they work in an ecosystem together, and that's what we are trying to enable as well, that the organic cotton talks also to the better cotton as well as the recycled cotton players. We all need to work together in getting a better, or I would say better grown cotton in industry.
Hi, sorry listeners, we seem to have lost audio from Toby, our moderator. So I'm Kate Chandler, also from Innovation Forum. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions, if that's okay with you two. Yeah. So my question is, there seems to be lots of pressure on you in this environment. Where are you feeling those pressures are coming from to make these changes, and how has that changed over the past decade and heading into 2020? Where do you think that's going to go? Is it going to stay the same?
Shall I start for a change?
Yeah, go for it. Thank you.
Okay. So if we look around us, we have seen the young generation, at least in Europe, in the last year, on the streets protesting for climate action. We've seen the European Commission and the new president of the European Commission calling for a new Green Deal. We are seeing our customers, I'm not talking about consumers, I'm talking about wholesale customers, pushing us as a Puma brand to sell more sustainable products to them. We see our shareholders being interested in what we're doing around sustainability and the various sustainability ratings and rankings that we are undergoing every year. And finally, we see our employees and co-workers who join us, and they are, some of them are of the same generation as those young people protesting in the street, and they are as well demanding that the company they work for is doing the right thing. So the pressure is coming from all directions. Is not a sort of a very specific pressure. It's more like, I would say, a general momentum that is building up, that companies like ours need to do the right thing and need to contribute their fair share to cleaning up the environment and being fair to people and so on. So that would be my 5 cents on that question.
Thank you very much, Kate, for stepping in for me while I was bumped off the internet for a couple of minutes and frantically logging back in. That's a great question around the pressures. I did catch a lot of the responses there. Just to follow up with you both, actually, on that point, you know, there are lots and lots of podcasts, media interviews, coverage of the fashion industry. We saw, you know, these protests at London Fashion Week by Extinction Rebellion and others who are tackling lots of different industries. But I did wonder if what you both feel about some of the numbers that are being thrown around about the climate change impact of the apparel and textile sector, because even some of the campaigners seem not to quite believe some of the extreme numbers we're seeing. And I wondered if you guys felt like there's some really unfair stats being thrown around about the impact, or are there? And the question is a difficult one for the companies like yourselves, is what can you do about that to kind of clarify things? Because we're all aware that your industry has a significant impact, of course. But are you concerned sometimes that the wrong information is getting around, and what can be done about that? Pascal, any thoughts on that?
Well, I have some thoughts on this. I actually pretty don't care about is it second, third, fourth or fifth position in terms of the most polluting industry. What I know is that we are an impactful industry, and with the growing population, the growing demand, it's not gonna end soon. So I think we have a responsibility to do things differently. It's not about being second or third. I think it's great actually that it's exposed in this kind of way towards public and media. I mean, we need to change, and we need to change what we consume, how, and with whom we consume. And I think it's a good thing that this comes into a transparent manner. And we have been driving and striving towards transparency for a very long time now. And hopefully we will get towards having an industry standard anytime soon that we can be transparent about and have clear targets, clear actions that everyone understand, everyone are consciously acting around it and be able towards to have a credible answer towards our customers in terms of climate impact of what they consume. So I think it's quite important. It's a very big and important debate. And it's not about being second or third for me. I don't think we have a role here to comment on the numbers. It's more, we have a role on what we do about it. That's what it is.
Okay, thank you. Stefan, what are your views on this?
I would agree to Pascal that we need to improve our impact and it doesn't really matter on which position we stand. But in order to calculate precisely the kind of impact we're having, of course, it is in a way important to get the right numbers and figures. And that is a challenge. So we talked about cotton before. And for example, BCI, which both of us are using at a big scale, has not come up with an emission factor, a carbon emission factor for its cotton. And that is also for a reason, because the emission factor for cotton is quite different in different countries and regions. So it's not so easy, it's not so straightforward to calculate greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, it's feasible. And as an industry, as we have started those industry initiatives, like the Fashion Charter on Climate Action, we're dedicated to supporting the process of getting the right figures. Scientifically correct figures out there, so that when we actually calculate our impact and also our reductions, we can at least sort of be half sure that this is also accurate. But yeah, in principle, I agree. Whether the impact is a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller doesn't matter so much. We need to reduce it and more turn it onto the positive side rather than looking at the negatives all the time.
Okay, thank you. I have a quick follow-up about that, and then I'm going to ask you some questions that have come in from the audience. You've mentioned the Fashion Charter on Climate Action. which sounds like it's that collaborative approach to tackle climate change. But some of our listeners may not be familiar with where it's come from and what it's trying to do. So could you just give us a bit of an overview, a bit more detail of the work you're doing there? And then, so that's for you, Stefan. And then, Pascal, I'll ask you if you want to come in on that and on the collaboration point as well. So, Stefan, tell us a bit more about the Fashion Charter on climate action.
Yeah, now you got me started, eh? I could talk forever on the Fashion Charter. So it's about it was launched in at the COP, so the UN Climate Conference in Katowice in Poland, about not last year but the year before, so about 1.5 years ago. And it's an initiative under the umbrella of the UNFCCC, or the United Nations Climate Secretariat, that reached out to our industry and asked us if we could join forces as the fashion industry to reduce our impact, and B, also use our marketing power and our power to influence people through fashion to make climate action actually chic and something positive for the consumers. So we responded as an industry. We responded to that call, and we started with a working group where a couple of brands were involved, around, I would say, 15 to 20 in the beginning. And then relatively fast within that working group, we came to the conclusion that there needs to be sort of a formal process or formal signature behind a commitment that those companies in our industry who want to do something about climate action could sign up to. And then we could start a more formal organization or industry collaboration behind that commitment. So we came up with this Fashion Charter, which has 16 individual commitments. The major commitment is a commitment towards climate neutrality until 2050 and a 30% reduction across all scopes, including supply chain, until 2030. And then there's individual commitments like using low carbon raw materials, or like working on circularity, or like phasing out coal-fired boilers from our supply chains, and so on and so forth. So we did launch the charter with 42, I believe, founding signatories in Katowice, and last year in Madrid at the UN Climate Conference, we were already over 100 signatories. I think now the current count is over 120. And most of the big players of our industry are in that charter, have signed up to that charter, and also many supporting organizations like a BCI, like a Sustainable Apparel Coalition, like a Textile Exchange, and others have signed as well. So we have 8 working groups in the charter, working on individual commitments, starting from a decarbonization working group, over raw materials working group, manufacturing, financing, climate action, and others. And so policy that is chaired by Pascal's colleague from H&M. And so we're working actively on that charter and on that commitment. And we're hoping that really with this collective industry movement, we can decarbonize our sector as fast as we need, and we don't have much time. As Pascal said in the beginning, we have about 10 years, so the clock is ticking.
Thank you. Pascal, any comments on this initiative and H&M for you?
Well, I mean, Stefan explained it very well, being very involved in the UNFCCC. But obviously, I mean, for us, it became a no-brainer of an industry collaboration and an opportunity to collaborate on a very important topic, and a very difficult topic as well, to create meaningful change on the ground. You can't do it alone. I mean, you have to get industry working together with every players, from suppliers to the brands, working hand in hand together with stakeholders and third parties. And obviously, I mean, all of that together, combining with the policy work towards towards governments and institutions, will create a change. So for us, it became a no-brainer that, of course, we have to be part of it, and it's one of the ways to create meaningful change. But it's not limiting to that. I think it's not because we have an industry commitment that it will create the change. We need to have committed brands working around the table for creating the change, and that's what we the whole work now it's yet to happen. I mean, it's a great initiative, but I think we need to make it successful. We need to have concrete work on the ground to make it relevant and impactful. And this is what the team, together with Stefan, are working on through the different working group and task force. And it's great to see some change already in terms of policy happening in different places or in different forums within the EU, to speak plainly. But it's definitely a great initiative, and we need to broaden it and get concrete actions coming out of it.
Great, thank you. I'm getting lots of very specific questions. I'm going to try and ask as many of them as I can in our remaining 20 minutes or so. About scope 3 emissions, and our questioner asks, in trying to understand the extent of scope 3 emissions, this can be incredibly difficult. Do you have a sight on where the bulk of your scope 3 emissions sit in the supply chain? And how did you go about figuring that out? I mean, that's obviously a major challenge on climate change. I note that BP has been highly criticized for their climate plan, which they announced the other day for the oil and gas sector, where their definition of scope 3 is not uniformly agreed. And, you know, it looks like they're in for some heavy criticism there of how they've calculated it. So I know it must be a bit of a minefield for you guys to try and look at scope 3. It'd be interesting just to hear from both of you about the journey there and how you're looking at it at the moment. So Stefan, why don't you start us off on your thinking on scope 3 emissions?
Yes, so we have used the environmental profit and loss account, as I said, to look specifically into the emissions from the different areas within our supply chain. We have also done the math on our own sort of transport of goods emissions, which are part of our annual report since years, business travel, etc. Some of the other more exotic scope 3 emission categories we have estimated. There are estimation tools out there from the Science Based Target Initiative, for example, that you can use for that. We had, at one point, we had a student who did a thesis around scope 3 emissions within Puma to get a first insight. But basically, what we found out is that really it's purchased goods and services, unsurprisingly, that is the vast majority share of our scope 3 emissions. So basically, it is our suppliers and their supply chains that really matter the most, and everything else is, I wouldn't say negligible, but much lower from a scale perspective.
Okay, thank you. And I want to, as a follow-up to that in a moment, after we hear from Pascal, I want to ask you then, you know, who should bear the cost of these changes in the supply chain and what you're doing with suppliers to help them in the transition, which is obviously key. But Pascal, first, over to you. Just clarify where you're thinking on scope 3 and where you are at the moment. Thank you.
Well, as discussed already, I mean, we have our science-based target approved as well. Basically, how it came up, I mean, I was part of the supply chain when we decided our scope 3 targets and emissions. So basically, I mean, it comes down to doing your own math. I think it's quite key. Looking at your emissions and start to set the baseline of your emissions. By having that done, then working with a third party, I mean, we have worked with a third party to define those those goals and getting it approved by science-based target initiative. Basically, I mean, you look into your whole value chain and your whole scope 3 supply chain in a holistic approach based on the growth that you plan and you target, how much of it will be reduced by having a better efficiency at suppliers, and basically by having the set targets and the set actions to decrease and to make sure that we are efficient enough in our actions. And then it's about setting targets on the renewable part and how much of the energy should come from renewables. So basically having a waterfall charts in terms of emissions and making sure that all of those numbers add up together towards a goal. So it's a quite intensive work, but very helpful as well to understand our impact and where we can work on decreasing and minimizing the impacts and making sure that we have publicly disclosed goals towards reducing climate impact.
Thank you. And then a follow-up question for you both, and I'm paraphrasing, by the way, you know, a lot of the questions that are coming in here, kind of grouping them together so that we can try and get through them. But a key question that's coming up, you won't be surprised to hear, that I mentioned before, is this idea of helping suppliers through the transition. You know, and comments are coming in saying, you know, brands want suppliers to change things, but they're not prepared to pay for it. And, you know, a lot of investment is required. Where does the money come from? A classic question, I suppose, in many senses. But interesting to hear from you both what your responses to that are, and perhaps for some concrete examples of where you're helping suppliers on that transformation, because that's clearly where the really big impact is. Stefan, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, first I would like to mention that energy efficiency and transition to renewable energy may require investment, but there's also a payback. So especially on the energy efficiency piece, we see that suppliers are actually gaining financially rather than losing financially if those suppliers go through a professional energy efficiency assessment for the first time or for the second time. Of course, once you have reaped all the sort of the low-hanging fruits there and carved out the easy efficiency gains, then this becomes a little bit more tricky. But we see, and we've seen in numerous projects, not only from Puma, but across the industry, Clean by Design, the IFC programs, etc., that those initiatives do pay off. So then the question is not really who is paying, it's more like identifying where there is a good opportunity to both reduce energy consumption and be financially more efficient. When it comes to investment in renewable energy, it's a bit of a different story, or it has been a bit of a different story. But we've also heard that in recent years, in many countries, there has been a breakthrough towards a renewable energy now becoming also cost competitive. So, for example, we worked with International Finance Corporation in the VIP program, Vietnam Improvement Program in Vietnam, as the name implies. And we did pay for feasibility studies for some of our biggest suppliers on rooftop solar. So the suppliers were happy to do that because we started with the initial investment. Maybe they would have paid it as well. I'm not sure. But eventually, after they saw the figures from those feasibility studies, they were ready to throw in their own money or to finance on their own a large rooftop solar installations, because there is a positive business case. And of course, they're not only asked by us as Puma to do that, but they are asked by other brands as well. And as we said, you know, Fashion Charter now has over 100 signatories. So I would not see this as black and white and brands asking, you know, poor suppliers to do things. I mean, those suppliers also have a responsibility. The countries where those suppliers are located, they have also signed the Paris Agreement. So we're also talking on the policy level to those countries and trying with our link within the UNFCCC, you know, to tell those industries, for example, on the industry level group, for example, BGMEA in Bangladesh, that they must have an own interest as well to decarbonize their industry, and this will help then a country like Bangladesh, to come back to that example, to also hit their Paris Agreement target. So I don't see this as black and white, as maybe the question had implied. I see it as a sort of a collaboration, and of course our scope 3 emissions are the scope 1 and 2 emissions of our suppliers. So we are in this together, and as I said, from a cost perspective, it's not only cost, there's also benefits to reap.
Great, thank you. Pascal, over to you.
Yes, great. Well, I fully agree with what Stefan said as well when he comes to, it's not a black and white answer to it. My take on this, I mean, obviously sustainability has a cost. There is no doubt about that. It has a cost today on brands. It has a cost today on suppliers. The whole thing, I think, that will make a difference in how do we divide that cost is basically it comes back to how the sourcing will evolve in coming years. We see that has started already a few years ago. I mean, that it comes to a more partnership approach, and it's not anymore a buyer to supplier relationship anymore, and that's what we need to protect and prevent. It's about partnership and long-term partnership. Only when that is there, then the question of black and white cost, where it goes and who pay for what, it should not come. I think it's about making sure that we have the right incentives for suppliers to be able to invest. It's about enabling and being the facilitator of different investment. I mean, we have done in that context of solar, bringing solar panels in Bangladesh, we have done a very good initiative that we call We Are One Roof, where basically we bring together all our biggest suppliers that having the largest rooftop availability, bringing them together with solar panels providers, and making sure that we have everyone around the table towards the same discussion. And basically, we have seen that by having those initiatives where the brands can bring a kind of scale, a kind of larger demand of solar panels, then we see that the developers are able to come back with preferential fees around it. And it makes the kind of the investment a bit easier and the return of investment shorter as well. So if we have to find creativity as well in how the brands can facilitate and enable the change. But it all come back, for me, it all come back to having a good supplier relationship management and how we incentivize suppliers for the job they do. By having clear targets, by having clear follow-up with our suppliers, we are able as well to reward sustainable action. And that's a kind of demand and give and take relationship that needs to happen. It's a partnership around creating a change. And this is a shift of mindset that we need to have. But either it has already happened for some brands, either it's yet to happen. But it's key and it's crucial that this will be an enabler for change.
Okay, thank you. We have about 5-6 minutes left. I want to ask you about two areas. And I don't know if we have enough time for them, but let's see how far we get. The first is about materials. We're getting lots of questions about how far down the road are you with alternative, improved materials. You know, we've seen now viscose and rayon become much more popular. There's much more of it on stream. There are more calculations about its impact. We've seen companies making socks out of nylon fishing nets and old carpets. You know, there are materials now which are much better than they used to be, shall we say, much more with a lower impact. So I just wanted to ask you both for a quick overview of your thinking on innovative materials, and then we'll try and finish off with a question about circularity and consumers if we have enough time. So just, Stefan, why don't you just try briefly and talk us through the point on materials? And I know it's a complex one, but I'm asking you to be brief if you can.
Yeah, I think I said it before. So in apparel, for example, we use mainly two materials. That's cotton and polyester. That's like 98% of the materials we use in apparel. So then it's not so much replacing cotton and polyester with viscose or so. It's more cleaning up and improving the material health of those materials that we're already using. On the footwear side, it's polyurethane, it's rubber, it's a couple of other materials, and here we're trying similar things. So it's inspiring, to have materials out of old fishing nets, and we are also telling those stories. We've just launched a first mile collection, which also has a recycled message there and the social component as well. But I think really we have to get to the heart of the matter and the core business, and that is where the majority of our materials are and also will be in the future. So for me, it's more important that those materials that we're using at scale, that they are getting more and more sustainable. And the other materials, they are great to tell a story. And, you know, in some niche applications, we are also using them, but they don't make the big impact for us.
Okay, thank you. Pascal, briefly, if you don't mind. I know it's a complicated question, as I mentioned.
It's a very important question. I think materials is basically the key enabler to decrease impact on natural resources and the environment. So we set, as I said, we set a goal that by 2030, 100% of our assortment will come from either recycled or sustainably sourced materials. And we are actively working on that. Today, we are at 57%. Obviously, innovation is key to achieve that, and innovation that can bring scale as well, that we can bring up to scale. We talked about cotton. Cotton is a big part of our assortment. It's about revising standards and making sure that we have standards that are continuously revised in order to create even more positive impacts. Then when it comes to new materials, I mean, there are plenty right now. I think it's quite inspiring to see all the innovators coming up with new materials. We will launch in the end of March, we will have a world launch of new materials that we call Circulose, which comes from recycled denims, which is a viscose-based cellulosic-based materials. We will have a vegan leather, which is basically a leather type of materials coming from residue from the wine industry. So there are a lot of innovation coming up, and it's great to see them coming. And I think the key around those innovations is how do we scale them? How do we scale them that those materials to become mainstream? And that's the main challenge here. And basically it's by having focus on those materials, by having working on innovation, working on making sure that they reply to a demand. That's the way that we will manage to bring them up to scale. But there are great innovation coming up, and I think we are just at the beginning of it. And the next big things will be around how do we make recycled materials becoming a mainstream. And this will be key for changing our industry and the materials.
Thank you very much. We've talked a lot on the webinar about the supply chain, about manufacturing and input. Let me finish off by asking you both about, once your products are sold in the hands of consumers, we know that's an enormous issue. And let me posit to you what might be a controversial question, and you can tell me if you think I've got this wrong. But my sense is from our plastics conferences that we do and this running this conference that we have on sustainable apparel and textiles the end of April, we've now run this for 5 or 6 years. And it seems obvious to me the individual brands getting materials back directly from consumers isn't really going to work. We can pretend that it will, but it seems to me that it isn't going to work, and I can see why. Too complex and so on. In which case, is the answer really going to be chemical recycling and resource recovery that way, which is across the industry and creates a kind of circular stream of materials where we can make the technology work? So interested in both your views on that subject. Pascal, why don't we come to you first, and then we'll ask Stefan to close. What are your views on what I've just said there, Pascal?
Well, I think I will tend to disagree. I think we have not seen yet the whole potential around recycling technologies to come to bring up to scale. We are piloting a few. We just got a groundbreaking innovation that came out in Hong Kong through our partnership with Hong Kong Rita, which separates blends of fibers between cotton and polyester. And we are just at the beginning of it. I think innovation will come, they will come to scale, and we will be able to use it for having new materials in place.
Yeah, I would concur. I mean, we don't have all the answers yet, that's for sure. So circularity is one of the buzzwords in our industry, and not only in our industry, but especially in our industry. And if we look at the percentage of recycled content or of materials that are circular, we have to be honest and say it's very low currently. So we need to work on this. And chemical recycling certainly is a possibility that we are pursuing from Puma and others are pursuing. But I think mechanical recycling shouldn't be discarded, as I'm hearing for cotton, for example. It is feasible, not for all products, but for certain products to mechanically recycle cotton. Same for polyester. So I think the decisions or the call hasn't been made out yet, or hasn't been made yet, on whether it will all be chemical recycling eventually or mechanical or a mixture of both. But the matter of fact is we need to recycle our own waste within our industry. We have to stop at one point using plastic bottles, which is just taking the waste of another industry and then making this other industry using virgin bottle material instead. So there's plenty to do on this pathway to getting more circular. And we see some good innovations, and hopefully we'll see some shift also in the percentage of use over the next years.
Great, thank you. And I think that's a good concluding place to end the webinar. Stefan and Pascal, thank you very much for your time and your frank comments today. Listeners, thank you for your questions. I grouped together and tried to ask as many of them as I could. We could have this conversation all day. And in fact, we will be doing so on the 28th and 29th of April in Amsterdam. Look at the Innovation Forum website and the Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference. And please come and join us all that to continue this conversation in more depth. But for now, I need to draw this to a close because we all have other things we must also do. But this will be available as a podcast on the Innovation Forum podcast channel. So just sign up for Innovation Forum on your podcast provider and you'll get it. And if you want to send a link to your colleagues, we will email you a link afterwards to the recording, which you can distribute to your heart's content. So I think we're done. Pascal, Stefan, once again, thank you so much for your time. And listeners, we hope to see you in Amsterdam, or we hope you can hear from us again with another podcast or webinar soon. Thanks very much to everyone.
Thank you.